Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific. 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my day. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Patriot Education, brought to you by a group of people who truly understand that they and you are the nation. Every single one of us contributes to this wonderful country of ours, ladies and gentlemen, by doing the very best that we possibly can in every situation we face. I want to invite you to visit us at www.patriotfamilies.com, where you'll meet people who care about this country and are more than willing to put everything they are on the line to protect, defend, and promote its ideals and aspirations. Tonight's topic on Patriot Education, ladies and gentlemen, is the three R's, irrelevant or essential. I remember long ago when I was a mere sprout that the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, were considered to be the fundamental need, the fundamental purpose, and the fundamental job of our educational system. Teaching our children to read, write, and to do arithmetic, to be able to add, subtract, multiply, and divide with whole numbers, fractions, decimals, and percents, was considered to be the foundation of all further education. If you could not do any one of those three, you were handicapped in trying to pursue the course of a lifelong learner. Now, we spend a great deal of time looking at data-driven measurements of children's self-esteem and progress and fitness for this, that, or the other career, or everybody goes to college whether we want to or should or not, or how do we stop bullying, and how do we socialize, and how do we deal with children whose families don't raise them the way we like and reteach them how they should be raised in school? We have gone from a basic education, the tools needed to be a lifelong learner and successful in this world of ours, to an all-encompassing nanny state view of what public education is supposed to be. Nobody worried a hair about my self-esteem when I was in school. They figured that my self-esteem was my joy and my problem, and that I would increase it by meeting and conquering any obstacles in my way, and that when I did, I would truly understand what self-esteem was. They weren't interested in raising me. That was my parents' job. If my social behaviors were unacceptable, my parents got told about it. And had they ever been so, they weren't, I was a good kid, I would have been punished doubly at home over and above what I got at school for unacceptable social behavior. Nobody told me it wasn't my fault because I was fill in the blank, whatever it is, you know, whatever disability I happen to have or challenge I happen to have or special need I happen to have. I was expected to acquire the social skills that were needed for me to interact with my fellow students, my teachers, administrators, and other human beings with a minimum of friction and with some degree of compassion, kindness, and courtesy. No one spent their time trying to inculcate in me these kinds of social values. That was left to my parents. And if I wasn't getting it at home, too bad. Perhaps I would pick it up at school if I watched other children acting responsibly and behaving well. If I didn't, I would no longer be in school. And then my parents would have had to shop around for some place that actually would take me if I were incapable of behaving in a socially acceptable manner. That is not the case now, however. Now, the educational system is somehow or other expected to be mother, father, grandparent, aunt, uncle, counselor, coach, life coach, psychological counselor, educational expert, behavioral therapist, and any other kind of title you want to bring up. And all of it is placed in the laps of our public school teachers. We are expected to provide all of these things, whether or not the student gets any reinforcement at home. And if we do try to provide them in a way that's unacceptable to the parents' ideas, we get sued for damaging the poor little creatures. And for my friends in the chat room, I'm having some computer issues, and all I've got is a nice smear of old blue and green and orange, and I can't see anything you're typing. So I'm not ignoring you. I just can't see you. I'm going to keep trying, but, you're back. Great. Terrific. It's nice to see my friends Yolanda and Linda in my chat room, and the mouse finally got it back for me. Now, back to the topic. The three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. It used to be that a standard eighth grade education was sufficient for anybody to continue their education on their own and to make progress in the material and in the academic world. If you could read and comprehend well, then you could always improve your vocabulary, expand your horizons, and add to your knowledge with a public library card, which was free, and generally, good parents got one for their kids the minute they were old enough to print their name legibly. That was the rule in my town, and I remember how proud I was. In second grade, the first week of second grade, my dad took me to the library, and I printed my name on the application form and understood what I was promising, and I got my very own library card. Because I'd gone to the library with Daddy on Saturdays for, about 3 years before that. And I got to read in the library, and he'd check out books for me. But now I could check out books for myself and take them home and read them. And I was responsible for bringing them back on time. Because if there was a library fine, it got paid out of my 25 cents a week allowance. My parents didn't pay it. Because having a library card was a civic responsibility. I understood this. and I was a dreadful nag when I knew my books were due, that we were going to the library, so I wasn't going to be fine, because my reputation at the Traverse City, Michigan Public Library would be gone forever if I had an overdue book. But that's the kind of reading, writing, arithmetic, okay, that we were brought up with, or that I was brought up with. I had the world open to me because I learned to read and to understand what I read, and that if I didn't know a word, I didn't skip over it. I asked somebody what it meant, or I grabbed a dictionary. Now, I am very fortunate, ladies and gentlemen. I have a very retentive memory, and words have always been like breathing to me. My grandmother told me that I was speaking in complete sentences when I was a year old, and I'm not at all surprised. My mother used to say that I came out talking. She was exaggerating just a bit, but she wasn't all that far off. But I loved words. I loved adding them to my mental vocabulary. I loved finding new ones that sang to me or whispered to me or scared me or gave me a new way to image the world. My friend Yo says her husband is laughing at my coming out talking. Well, he's met me. He knows. But I was lucky. It's not anything I tried to do or anything that was difficult for me. It came naturally. Math, on the other hand, was not quite such a natural skill. I hated it. If I could have avoided numbers until I was 40 or so, I would have quite cheerfully done it. But I memorized my times tables, my addition and subtraction facts. I figured out shortcut methods to do multiplying and dividing. I learned how to understand the applications of the four operations when it came to word problems. As a matter of fact, word problems was the only part of math I ever enjoyed, because at least it had some practical use in those. Otherwise, it was just a bunch of symbols and a bunch of quantities, and yeah, so what? 7 times 8 is 56. What am I going to do? Send up a fireworks? But once I began to do word problems, I began to understand that math, unpleasant as it isn't actually a useful skill. Kind of like cleaning toilets. I don't enjoy doing it, but when I have to, I can, and I would prefer to be able to do it myself so that I don't have to pay for an expert to clean my toilet or live in a house full of germs and smells. When it came to writing, I wasn't very good with forming my letters well. I still have some things that I wrote when I was like 7 or 8, and Egyptian hieroglyphs would have been a lot neater and a lot more understandable. But eventually I learned, and I began to see writing as something pleasurable when I was taught cursive in third grade. I am something of an artist. I can draw and I can paint. And to me, cursive and lettering were art forms. And I enjoyed practicing my cursive. All of those loops and S's and figure eights and funny-looking V shapes that good little Catholic girls in third grade had to put in their handwriting notebook, after a while, they got easier and easier, and I also discovered the wonderful boon of cursive writing. It was faster than manuscript. So when I had a book report to do, instead of taking an hour to write, it only took 40 minutes, because I didn't have to lift my pencil off the paper every time I wanted to change letters. So I did learn to write. Not only physically and spell the words correctly, but to express myself as clearly and concisely as I could, and I fell in love with the wonder of imagery. Using words to paint the picture that my not very cooperative fingers couldn't quite manage to get on a canvas or a piece of watercolor paper. And to this day, words are my crayons, my paintbrush, my engraving tool, my sculpture. I use words the way as a child I used my crayons, to make a picture for the enjoyment or the enlightenment or the entertainment of others. I'm still doing it, sitting here doing it tonight, and it does give me joy. I try to teach this by example to my students. I had three young men in my classroom today who, now let me take that back, there were four of them, three out of the four did not comprehend what they read. They read the words as if they were a parakeet repeating a phrase or a whistle or a name. But what the words were saying didn't penetrate. I had to go back with each one of them in their history and their English and even their math and get them to reread it aloud, and then I read it aloud, and then I took it apart and rephrased it because none of them paid any attention to what the words actually said. One of them was doing a series of readings and then taking notes on a comparison between the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Virginia. They're quite similar since ours is built on the federal Constitution. And one of the questions that was asked, there was a section on amending the Constitution. And it listed the various ways in which the Virginia Constitution could be amended and what it took to get the amendment ratified, etc. And he sat there for 40 minutes staring at it, complaining he didn't understand and he couldn't answer the question about what happens to amend the Virginia Constitution. And that was after highlighting practically every word in the Cotton Pickin article. Oh, they love highlighters, these kids. The whole article is green or purple or red or blue or orange. Everything. The function of highlighting is, let's make the paper look pretty. We didn't have highlighters. You know, the nice little smelly things that come out in really pretty bright colors when I was in grade school. We used a pencil to underline things. Or we drew a circle around it if it was important. Or we took notes in class and wrote down the things our teacher said that we knew we were going to be tested upon. Now we have highlighters. And everybody seems to think they're just a neat way to make a rainbow out of whatever manuscript you're trying to read. It doesn't really matter what you highlight, just so long as you highlight something. I mean, I had one kid, not today, but in the past, who highlighted the word the all the time. And I asked him why, and he said, well, it's an important word. Look at it. It's got a capital letter. Because there was a sentence that started with the, and it had a capital T, so obviously that makes every the in the page something important. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the result of the three R's aren't necessary. They're irrelevant these days. We need to teach our kids to be career ready. We need more computers. We need bigger and grander schools. We need radio stations and animal husbandry classes and 60,000 after-school activities. And the football team needs new uniforms. And we've got to have state-of-the-art video so we can give lectures on how it's not nice to bully people. But do we teach our kids to read? Do we expect them to read? Do we require them to read? Very rarely. If you look at the infamous Common Core standards, the 50-50 supposedly split between quote-unquote informational reading and actual reading classics or articles or stories or poetry or novels, is intended to make our kids career ready. In other words, it's training them to be happy members of the collective who can read the maintenance manual so they can plug in the new limb into the guy in the cubicle next to them. The old-fashioned three R's, ladies and gentlemen, good old reading, writing, and arithmetic, may very well be old-fashioned. But why is old-fashioned automatically wrong in our culture? We have a history in the United States, ladies and gentlemen, that is the result of our pioneer culture. The fact that the vast majority of people who are living in this nation now have ancestors who came here because they weren't satisfied with where they lived before. They wanted the new. They wanted a better chance. They wanted wider horizons. We explored and settled a land that was greater than Europe over a matter of 150 years. Because we were and are pioneer thinkers, the new is always more attractive than the traditional. or the known. This is a powerful ethos, ladies and gentlemen, and it's made this country great. But we have become so in love with the idea that if it's new, it must be better, that we are setting aside things that have value, real, lasting, eternal value, in favor of a glittery, shiny, new toy. And unfortunately, that's what's happening in our public education. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy technology. I do not want to beat my clothes against a rock in the river. I don't want to haul water from the well. I do not want to stoke my fire and bank it and cook over a wood stove. I do not want to heat my flat iron on top of the wood stove. And I don't want to have to haul the water and everybody take a bath so that I don't have to haul it more than once, so we only bathe one night a week. I like technology. I love being a softened product of civilization. I thoroughly enjoy it. I like pushing a button, and my coffee maker comes on, makes coffee in the morning, and it's hot and ready for me to pour when I get up out of bed in the morning. I love it. Sybaritic life or not, it's wonderful. But I also know that if my coffee maker quit, okay, if my electricity went out, I have a propane stove that isn't run by electricity on which I can boil some water, okay, and I can pour it into my coffee maker filter, my coffee pot filter with ground up coffee, and I have a hand grinder, and I can have something to drink. Now, I don't think I could manage to cook over an open fire. I probably could if I absolutely had to. It's not something I want to try, but doggone it, if it was that or starve, guess who'd be out there cooking over the nice open fire, turning the spit, and poking the kettle hung from the tripod? Me. Because even though I never had to live that way, I had ancestors who did. And I have an inquiring mind, and I read a great deal. And I could probably find out from good old-fashioned books exactly the best way to lay that fire, how to bank it so it would be there in the morning in my wood stove. I could learn to live like that if I had to, because I have been trained to learn. Not recite, not repeat, not circle something on a multiple choice quiz, not do multiple guess by eliminating at least two out of the five and then taking a wild stab with a pin at the other three. Because I was taught to read and retain what I read. I was taught to think about what the words told me and to put them in context with my life and my experience and use them to broaden that life and broaden that experience if I possibly could. I didn't read so I could pass a test. I read because it was wonderful. I could go anywhere in the world and any time in history through the medium of words on the printed page. I could teach myself how to do algebra, and I did, because through a glitch at the school I attended, I got put in an advanced algebra class, and I'd never seen this stuff before. So I had to go and teach myself when I was a tutor so that I could teach others. This is what being a lifetime learner is. This is what our children are not receiving. It isn't that they are all budding geniuses and they were all amazingly good at the stuff and all they needed was the teacher to say the right words and they would immediately know everything. Some kids are going to struggle with something or everything in academics because for whatever reason, it does not come easily to them. But instead of promising them and threatening them if they don't come through a college degree so they'll make more money, we need to be focusing on giving them the basic skills so that they can get a job at McDonald's and not get fired. Yes, college is wonderful. Yes, I wanted it. My sister, middle sister, did not. My parents would have loved to have sent her to college, but she wasn't interested. So as much as they would have liked it, they certainly didn't kick her out of the house or browbeat her or tell her she was useless because that wasn't her path. She went to work, and she got married, and she had kids, which is what she wanted to do. My youngest sister wanted college. mainly because she wanted to get out from under mother and daddy and raise a little Hades, and she did. But she did finish, and she did get her degree. No two kids follow the same identical path in their lives, in their characters, in their experiences, or in their academic career. We need to give every child who comes through our hands in public school as many of the basic tools as we can. And I am terribly sorry for those who can't grasp these things in the 1 or 2 years it takes to learn to read and the additional 10 years it takes to advance one's vocabulary and knowledge. If it takes them 5 years to learn how to read at what we call an eighth grade level, so be it. Keep them where they can learn it. Don't artificially socially promote them so they won't feel bad, and then get them out of high school, throw them in the job market, and then have to support them for the rest of their lives because they don't know anything and don't have the tools to learn it. If I were a conspiracy theorist, ladies and gentlemen, I would see this as the biggest plot to undermine the freedom of every single man and woman in this country that has ever been hatched in the most insane mind one could think of. Because that, if we continue it, is exactly what's going to happen. When our children cannot learn for themselves, but expect others to give them the answers to everything in their lives, where is our nation? It lies bleeding, wounded unto death on the scrap heap of history. Because the only thing that keeps this nation going, ladies and gentlemen, in the direction that our founding fathers intended, is an educated electorate. People who can read and think about what they read and learn and choose their elected officials wisely. Not pick a name because it sounds familiar because they saw it 37,000 times on television. But because that individual represents an idea, a direction, a plan with which they agree and that they feel is good and positive for the nation as a whole. We are so interested in the shiny new technological toys and all of the lovely statistical charts and the let's groom them for whatever niche in the collective they should fit, that we lose track of the fact that you do not have to have a calculator and a Promethean board and a handheld GPS and a Kindle and an iPad with a reading app. You don't have to have these things to learn. They are wonderful tools, but they cannot learn for you. Learning occurs in the human brain, not in the hand on the calculator. I had a young lady in my ISS room today who, when I asked her to subtract 1 from 9, reached for her calculator. I said, "What are you doing? Come on, you can do that." And immediately she said, "It's 8. This is what I mean. We are creating stupid. My friend Linda says, unfortunately, people without a brain, you just can't fix stupid. Well, our public education system is promoting stupid. Yes, it is. Don't pay any attention to the, oh, look how well we're going to be doing. Look, we're going to have everybody graduating. Yeah, and you know how they're going to do it? They're going to give them test grades. They are going to give them social promotions. They are going to give them a piece of paper that says, I graduated from high school. And then they're going to dump them into the workforce where they will flounder and sink and flounder and sink and eventually ride the welfare raft for the rest of their natural lives. And it's not just one ethnicity, one socioeconomic group. It's all of them. It used to be that demographics played a part in academic success. They still do to a degree, because the higher the material success of your family, the more likely you are to have access to things like books and magazines and newspapers and go to the library and watch the news and talk about world issues. But demographics do not doom you to failure. All you have to do is go back and look at many of the people, like Martin Luther King, in the 1960s, who stood up for civil rights, who didn't go to nice white suburban schools. Or you look at a gentleman like Dr. Benjamin Carson, who was raised by a single mother with four or five brothers, all of whom were told that if they didn't learn to read and do well in school, they'd have to face up to mama, and mama wasn't going to like it. So demographics don't determine your success in life. You can come from the wealthiest family in town and be a slack-jawed, stupid idiot if that's what you want to be. Or you can come from the poorest, most deprived, most socially outcast group of people in your entire county and have that spark and find one person who blows on it and turns it to a flame, and you can be a Dr. Benjamin Carson. We spend so much time trying to compensate everybody in some way so that everyone will be Albert Einstein without the dyslexia, okay, or Leonardo da Vinci, okay, or Bill Gates, or some other iconic individual who is the epitome of success. Well, guess what, folks? It's not going to happen. You can't make everyone average and have anybody be exceptional. If you want exceptional, you're not going to get it from everybody, because the word means something that's out of the ordinary. Progressives do not understand English. I swear they don't. To be exceptional is not a bad thing, indicating that you are a stuck-up snob with your nose in the air who looks down at everyone who doesn't have your money, your lineage, or your education. To be exceptional means to stand out from the crowd in some way, to exceed the ordinary limits or the ordinary status. And without exceptional people, like astronauts and engineers and Thomas Edison and Da Vinci and all the rest, we would not have what I'm sitting here using to talk to you today. Progressives, unfortunately, are suffering from a mental disorder. It's called idiocy. They envision a world in which they are in charge and in control of a group of grateful, fawning acolytes who bow and scrape and kiss their feet for the daily bread and the warm house and the nice college degree that they are given by these kind, generous philosopher kings. Well, even if it could happen, I wouldn't want it, ladies and gentlemen. Granted, I did not enjoy bringing home a D in Algebra 1 on my first report card when I had never had anything below a B on a report card in my life, and showing it to my father, the aeronautical engineer. Trust me, it wasn't fun. It was downright doggone scary. And I went through a bad few days there with lots of tears trying to explain that I didn't know what they were talking about. And finally, my dad sat down with me, and we looked at the algebra book together, and I showed him what it was I was supposed to be doing. And I said, "What does this mean?" And he said, "What do you mean? You don't know?" I said, "No, Daddy, I've never seen that before." And I hadn't. It was deriving a square root manually, not with a calculator. And I hadn't. I knew. I had no idea what they were talking about. I barely knew what it meant to square something. That was when he marched down to the school and to the guidance office and started to investigate. And that's when the error in scheduling was discovered, because I didn't complain. I just suffered and tried to figure it out. I thought I was stupid, because everybody else seemed to understand it, but it didn't make any sense to me. My teacher was not a very patient woman. She assumed, because my record in school was so outstanding across the board, that I was just, you know, being willfully dumb or refusing to study or making difficulties. I wasn't. I was lost. And once we figured it out, I managed to, with a lot of help from my dad and a lot of studying, scrape a C by the end of the year. It wasn't until I was a professional tutor myself and had to teach algebra to others that I got a hold of a pre-algebra book, and all of a sudden, that's what they were talking about, and it made sense, and from then on, I was fine. But I had to wait till I was in my 20s. I managed to pass my college math. I only had to take one quarter of it, because I took logic my first semester, and then I transferred to a non-Catholic school and took a basic college algebra course and managed to get a B in it. I still think it was a mistake grading the exam, but I never went and asked for fear that they'd found out they'd given me the wrong grade. So it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I actually learned the basic stuff, because I had to teach it to others. But again, that comes back to the way I was taught with the basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. I had a textbook. I could read. I could understand what the words were saying to me. I could look at the examples and the illustrations and read the captions and read the definitions and understand what they meant, because I had been taught how to learn. I had been given the skills I needed to teach myself. And that is what I wish our public education system would start focusing on. Forget everybody's career ready, everybody goes to college. Go to making sure that nobody gets out of the eighth grade and into high school who cannot read. If we have to go back to the old, quote-unquote, tracking system that was used in the 1950s, that I am a product of, that allowed children who didn't comprehend and didn't learn at the same pace as others to be in classes where the material was presented at the pace they could understand, instead of this asininity of sticking them into average and above average classes and collaborative learning, so they won't feel bad about themselves and the kids who don't have special needs will learn compassion. Oh my God. If we would just stop listening to the progressive, oh so compassionate idiocy, and start looking at children as human beings. Not perfect little angels, not inevitably vicious and evil demons who, if you tell them a gun exists, they'll immediately go find one and kill people, but human beings. My friend Linda says, what they used to call remedial. Yes, a remedial, now it's a bad word. Well, it comes from a remedy. A remedy is fixing something. A remedy is making something better, or making something that is not well, well. We do this with words, ladies and gentlemen. We change their definition, their denotation, and give them a connotation, a flavor of bad. And then the sense of what they were really meaning and what it was for goes away. They give it some other word, like calling a janitor a custodial engineer or a building maintenance expert or something, you know, because the word janitor is demeaning. No, it's not. Neither is remedial. It means something. It means something to fix something that isn't working correctly. Something to give someone who is having trouble a remedy, a fix, so that they can do better and succeed. And my friend Linda says the progressives change the words, and she's right, like I just said. They do. Because if they can make a word nasty or bad, it's exactly like playing the good old-fashioned wins-every-time race card. If they can accuse those who believe in certain fundamental principles of being stupid or stigmatize them or demonize them in some way by making the word that they might use to describe a situation automatically bad in some way, racist, demeaning, whatever it is, okay? They will do it. The absurdity is kind of like the atheist group that doesn't want the Air Force Academy cadets to say at the end of their oath of allegiance on getting their wings, "So help me God." I never have been able to figure out why people who don't believe in God are so worried that somebody else is going to use God's name. Why do they care? Why on earth does it matter? If you don't believe God exists, what on earth makes you think that calling on him is going to do anybody any good? What, or not being allowed to is going to change anything? I really don't completely agree with my friend Linda. She says they're nut jobs. I don't really think they're nut jobs. I just think they're control freaks. If you don't believe what I believe, you're obviously wrong and dangerous. I meet a lot of people like that. I meet a lot of kids like that. And this goes back to the progressive changing the meanings of words. The idea that it is somehow unkind or prejudicial or demeaning to disagree with someone's views about something. You might offend them. Well, tough cookies. So, what are they going to do? Curl up and die like the so-called sensitive plant? I'm offending them and they're just going to, like a fish, be pulled out of the tank and laid on the floor and gasp until they're dead? I've been offended many times in my life, and I'm still here. Reasonably healthy, a little dizzy, but aside from that, my brain works, my body works fairly well. I'm legally competent, shall we say. And people have offended me off and on my whole life, and I'm sure I've offended them too. But as far as I know, I don't think that I have ever been offended unto death, since I'm sitting here breathing and talking, nor do I believe that I have ever offended anyone else unto death, either. Almost anything can be offensive if it pushes a button on someone who has a sore spot. I was offended many times when people called me chubby. I didn't like the fact that I was overweight, and it was offensive for people to point it out to me. It hurt my feelings. I knew I was. I didn't need them to tell me so. But guess what, folks? I didn't die of it, and I certainly didn't go home and kill myself. I have been offended, and I'm sure I have offended. Merely by not agreeing with someone else's opinion. I have never in my mind, that I can remember, deliberately set out to make someone else unhappy or to be cruel or to denigrate anyone. Not ever that I can remember. But neither have I spent my life attempting to be someone I was not for fear of offending others. If any of you out there listening tonight are offended by what I say, I feel sorry that you have taken it that way, but I will not retract it unless it is factually incorrect. Okay? If you want to call in and tell me I'm offensive and explain why, that's fine. But that is not going to change my viewpoint, which is based on my life experience, my knowledge, my perceptions, and my understanding of myself and the universe in which I live, and the fellow beings with which I share it. Lord knows everybody can be wrong. Everybody and anybody can be wrong. And I have been many times. And I've made bad choices and wrong decisions. And I probably will until the day they close down the casket lid or throw me in the crematorium. But that's the state of being a human being. Being born does not guarantee that you will always be right. Being born does not guarantee that everything will always go the way you want it to. Being born does not give you the right to be offended and refuse to allow others to have an opinion different from your own. Nor does it give you the right to go about creating and causing chaos, cruelty, and pain for your own pleasure. Our children are not going to become perfect because they didn't come from perfect parents and they don't live in a perfect world. With luck and a good education and a caring family and wise friends and relatives and good relationships, they will become the very best them that it's possible to be. And hopefully they'll bring something to the world that no one else could bring. But it will have to be their particular gift, not one that's wrapped and tagged and placed in their hands for them to carry to someone else. It will be a gift that they have crafted with their minds, their hearts, and their souls. And it's our job to give them the tools to create that gift. Not to determine what the gift will be, not to decide just how big it ought to be or that it ought to look like everybody else's gift or we need some of these gifts so we're going to get you trained to make only these because everybody else is making too many of them, so we need you to make these other ones that nobody wants to make. No. The gift we bring to the universe is ourselves and what we make of ourselves. And it's a gift that literally does keep on giving. Because it gives not only to the world outside us, it gives to us as well. It gives to those who have taught us and raised us and mentored us and cared for us. Because those of us who have done the teaching and the parenting and the mentoring, we are not going to be there to see the results at the end of those lives we've helped push out into the world. At least not physically there. But if we have the hope that we will be able to look at those lives from whatever place we go to next and say, wow, isn't that a wonderful person that we helped make? And it's not for that that we do it, although that's part of it. It's because we know that if we can help a person be the wonderful them that they are, they will in turn help others to be their wonderful selves. And it grows. And it makes this world even more beautiful with every single person who comes into it. Never perfect, but getting better day by day. We need to remember that there are some old-fashioned things, like the three R's, that are essential. They never become irrelevant. Just like a good old-fashioned hand axe. Yes, you can replace it with gigantic earth-moving machines and huge choppers and chainsaws and gigantic stuff like that. But if you happen to be lost in the wilderness after a plane crash or a car crash, those things aren't going to be in your pocket. There's an axe in your trunk of your wrecked car, and you're alive, you can probably stay alive until somebody does find you and get you to medical care and warmth and food and shelter. But if you can't, you can at least make some for yourself. That's why we still make axes, ladies and gentlemen. And as wonderful as Kindles and tablets and iPads and iPhones are, we also still make books. We make books. Because we know that the written word and the ability to decode it is how we can learn from history so that we are not doomed to repeat it. We study ancient cultures and puzzle over their monoliths and their artifacts and their paintings and their art because they did not leave us a written language. Those cultures that did, such as ancient Egypt, Greece, Rome, China, the Sumerians, the ancient Hebrew peoples, we are the richer because we can look back through history and see what they saw and think about what they thought about and examine the way they explained the world around them. Because there were, quote-unquote, books, there was the written word, there was a record that someone thousands of years down the line will be able to look at and understand how we lived, what we did, and why we did it, and learn from our mistakes so that they can make things better instead of going back to the old bad status quo. It horrifies me, ladies and gentlemen, when I see these kids, and they're good, decent kids, most of them, being passed from grade to grade, unable to read and comprehend at fourth grade level, sent off to high school, and then dumped into the working world. It's frightening. And it's very, very sad. Over and above the difficulties they're going to have, and to be quite honest, the social and economic cost to me and those of us who do work and pay taxes, I am sad because of what they're going to miss. The embarrassment, the sense of inadequacy, the anger that's going to grow in them because they cannot do what is expected of them as an adult citizen. I've mentioned before an adult student that came to our tutoring center. He was a very skilled, very talented, very highly paid auto mechanic. Very, very good at his job. Understood engines as if he, you know, lived in them. Loved NASCAR, was an incredible race fan, graduated from high school, but he couldn't read. Well, he finally got tired of having to order steak or eggs on restaurant menus because he couldn't read them to choose something different. And he got tired of getting lost on his way to a race because he couldn't read the road signs. So he came to us to learn how to read. And when he came, he was in his 30s, and he was able to barely decode first grade words. After 4 years of getting tutored 2 or 3 days a week and paying for it himself, he was reading and comprehending on a 12th grade level. And it was as if the world had opened up for him. He could pick up NASCAR magazines and read stories about his favorite drivers and modifications to the cars and what was going to happen at the next race. He could read newspaper articles. He could read letters, and he could write them. He never had to worry about eating only steak when he was on the road going to a race. He could order anything he wanted, and he got to try a lot of brand new dishes that he'd never had before because he could figure out what the menu said and order them. So, I'm sure somebody back in his school days didn't see or wasn't able to give him the kind of one-on-one help that would help him to learn to use that skill, to acquire it and use it for his own betterment, his own entertainment, his own enjoyment. I am extraordinarily proud and grateful to the woman who owned the tutoring center, who happens to be the mother of my husband, and the fact that it was there. This was long before my husband and I got together as a couple. But that gentleman, to my mind, is a poster boy for the relevance of the three R's. He didn't need a college degree. He needed what every single citizen in this nation needs. He needed a standard, used to be, eighth grade education to be able to read and understand an employment application, a road sign, a menu in a restaurant, a brochure from the government delineating his benefits under Social Security, a magazine article, and nowadays a website that might give him information about how to do something with some of the newer cars that have more electronics, a manual for fixing the newer engines that weren't Shade Tree Mechanic fixable. He had that tool. He had that tool. And that alone, ladies and gentlemen, that one person gaining it would justify the existence of me and my husband's mother and our business. Because that was the whole point of our business. We were in business to provide the tools to the kids who were having trouble and needed individualized tutoring to present the material in a way they could understand. We don't need, oh, looky, Johnny can pass the standardized test now. Isn't that wonderful? It's not about Johnny passing a stupid standardized test. It's about Johnny being able to read the freaking employment application so he puts his name in the right box. Standardized tests have their place. They are a useful measure of both the child's retention of materials and facts at a particular grade level, and they're a fair measure of whether or not the schools are giving the children those facts, that knowledge, those concepts, and those skills in a timely fashion. But they are not the reason for learning. Unfortunately, under progressive leadership in public education, they have become the reason for quote-unquote learning. Only it isn't learning. It's parrot and parakeet training. It's test-taking strategies, okay, and so-called study skills. That means you write down what the teacher tells you is the meaning of the word, and you memorize it so you recognize the first and last word, and you can choose it as one of the four or five multiple-choice answers. Not so you actually know what the word means and can use it in conversation, just so you can recognize that this has this word in it, so it must mean this one, so I got it right on the standardized test. And that's what education is becoming. The owner's manual for your cubicle in the board collective. And it's not even really an owner's manual because your cubicle belongs to everybody. And you just happen to be in it until your parts wear out and we can't fix you anymore. And then we just shove you out the locker and somebody else gets your cubicle, which is pretty much the progressive way of doing business. And I know everybody, Doc mentioned Bush and the No Child Left Behind. Well, what most people don't realize is No Child Left Behind came out of a Democratic majority House and Senate. And Bush was told that if he didn't sign it, his veto would be overridden and it would be passed anyway. And no, it's not just our current president. He's the product of the climate we created over the last 30 some odd years. He is the result of what has been going on in our public schools for 30-plus years now. The shift in thinking away from common-sense practical education to give people the tools they need to continue educating themselves, to everybody deserves a college degree and a $150,000 a year starting job the minute they get out, and if we don't give it to them, we are unkind and we are not giving everyone their equal rights. There's also, I have a little bit of a quarrel with that there's a right to an education kind of thing, too. You have a right to the opportunity to learn. But an education isn't something you put in a pill, stuff down a child's throat, and send him into the world saying, look, he's fixed, he's got an education. An education is the sum total of what the individual has learned. And unless they've learned it, then they don't have an education. They have a piece of paper that says they were present in a school for a certain length of time and managed to achieve a certain grade on a set of tests. And that's what we've got, not an education. Now, there are hundreds of thousands of kids who are getting educated simply because you couldn't stop them from getting educated. They're the kids who, if you stick them in a parking lot with a set of encyclopedias, they'll learn. They don't need a standardized test. They don't need somebody to wipe their delicate little tails every time they need to go to the bathroom. They don't need somebody to give them answers because they're curious and they're interested and they like to think. And that is something that is born in one. There are also hundreds of thousands of children who could become that kind of lifelong learner if somebody would expect it of them. Instead of telling them, oh, you can't help it, you poor little thing, I'll do it for you. Try motivating to build your own self-esteem instead of handing it to you on a nice little silver plate with a ribbon on top. And then there are probably hundreds of thousands of children who cannot learn sufficiently well to rise beyond labor force, doing a good job at something that doesn't require a great many academic skills, but having the desire to be independent and to work hard so that they can earn the money they're paid. There is no real answer or quick fix to this. And I stand corrected, Doc. I remember now it was proposed by Bush. But what it was intended to do was to funnel the Department of Education's money into programs that would help remediate those who were having difficulty. In other words, plumping up special education, creating extra teacher positions with federal funding so that students who could not keep up in a traditional classroom would have the resources they needed so that they would not just be passed socially. But that's not how it's been applied. It is definitely not how it's been applied. It has been applied to reinforce that everything is a disability under the ADA as it applies to education. Because once you get your child labeled as having a disability, guess what? Federal money. Federal money comes to you because you have a disabled child. This is the problem that we have with things that sound good but are not intended to do good. And the No Child Left Behind and the AD amendments are both examples of those things. Nobody wants to stand up and say, no, I'm against all handicapped people. They shouldn't get any help. This is bad. Which is exactly how opposing either one of those things would have been touted in the press. Anybody who stood up against them, who saw the potential consequences and misuse, would immediately be demonized as hating handicapped people, racist, bigoted, cruel, terrorists who want to hold down people who are handicapped or march them into the ovens or some silly thing. And they always forget that the guy who was busily marching people into the ovens was good old progressive socialist Hitler. Progressives are very good at sounding delicious and poisoning you as a tasty, delicious pill goes down. They're also very good at rewriting history, and they're absolutely excellent at ignoring truth, either because they refuse to see it or because they are so mentally dysfunctional that they can't recognize it when it walks up and steps on their foot. But there are many of us out there, ladies and gentlemen, many of us who are not ready to swallow the poison pill. And the number of us who are noticing that the sugar coating covers something very rotten is increasing daily. And we can thank the wonderful inventions of technology for that, because there are folks out here on the internet, blogging, writing, doing radio shows, talking to their neighbors across the country, and telling what they believe to be the truth, and telling people to wake up and smell the coffee. And yeah, it sounds good on Monday, but when you find out how much it's going to cost and how it doesn't work on Friday, you've bought the pig in the poke, and you're left with nothing. The more of us who stand up and speak out, and hello to Melinda in the chat room, and she just mentioned that they are very good at altering history, and particularly with regard to the slavery question, that it was always all the Republicans' fault, and so on, and she's correct, it wasn't. The Democratic Party was the party of control in the South during the slavery years. And it was the radical Republicans, okay, after the Civil War, who basically wanted to punish the South so badly that they wanted to rub their nose in the fact that they lost their rebellion. And they took the opportunity to do so by forbidding anyone who had held any office or served in the Confederate forces from the franchise, which meant that the people who actually could have maybe figured out a way to end the situation without putting in things like Jim Crow laws were alienated and shoved out of the political process. It's also the Republican Party that and the NRA that were responsible for and were formed, the NRA was formed, basically as part of its original intent to provide freed slaves after the Civil War with the means to defend themselves against groups like the KKK. History is not everybody always does right. History is not everybody is angelic. History is not every leader was perfect. They weren't. They were human too. And they did things that they thought were right at the time that turned out wrong. And they fought things that they thought were wrong that in the end turned out to be right. That's because we're people, not gods. We cannot see the myriad ripples in the universe of our actions. We can only see so far ahead. Melinda mentioned that Alan Grayson said that the Republicans are the KKK. No, the Ku Klux Klan was formed by disenfranchised Democratic Southerners after the Civil War because of the situation where a lot of folks came down from the North, the carpetbaggers, and basically bought up all of the land for pennies on the dollar because nobody could make any money to pay their taxes. And with that land, they owned property, so they had power. And with that power, they used it to, quote-unquote, whip the South into shape. and they used it to place in power freed slaves as tokens, which angered the Southerners, okay, and which did not help the freed slaves, because they weren't interested. They were interested in power, like any other politician, any other rapacious, greedy entrepreneur. Power corrupts, ladies and gentlemen, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Nobody is ever 100% right 100% of the time. We cannot achieve that. It's an unrealistic goal. All we can do is try to look as far down the road as we can, given our human limitations, and think of what the potential consequences of our actions might be, and then try to choose the path that gives us the most positive consequence. We cannot know at this present moment whether that will actually be a positive consequence. We believe it will, but we are not God. And one of the problems that I have with progressives is that they are firmly convinced that there's a job opening at the top of the heavenly ladder, and every single one of them is better qualified to fill it than the current deity. This is the result. What we're going through now, ladies and gentlemen, is the result of the progressives in charge of our educational system with an ulterior motive of destroying individuality, because individuality is dangerous to the holders of power. I have a caller, and I think that's Miss Linda. Hello there.
Hi, Miss Terry. It is Linda from California. The left of the left, yeah, coast.
Yeah. Kidnap your mother and bring her to Virginia. Kidnap her. Kidnap her. Put her in the trunk.
I know.
You know, soda or something. The shop.
It's amazing what you're talking about, those progressives, because, you know, they use the Olsky tactics very well. And as far as Representative or whatever that guy's name is, Grayson, he needs to talk to Dorothy of the Wizard of Oz, because maybe she can find a brain for him. I
doubt
honestly
it.
Don't.
Even if she did, it probably wouldn't fit. You can't put
remember
a brain
the line in the movie?
Head. Oh, yeah.
You remember the line in the movie where she says, well, what would you do with a brain even if you had one?
Exactly. Uh-huh.
That's what I like to say. Well, you know, they talk about these things like the right of health care, the right to a job, the right to education. This is nonsense. This is FDR's Second Bill of Rights to put socialism on us.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
What happened was the people in this one group on the Facebook where they was like a whole bunch of them, they had these handmade signs and it says health care is a right. And when I posted, oh, did I let them have it? I said, no, health care is a commodity, food.
Yes.
Like shelter, like everything else. And you have the right to go out and get it for yourself. Yeah, it's a good or commodity service, whatever. And you go get it for yourself, and nobody is supposed to be taken from them to force at the point of a gun to pay for it for you. I'm not talking about biblical charity. You know about that. We know that's what the churches are for. We're not going to abandon the elderly, et cetera. But I'm talking about those able-bodied, and these were people quite young and able-bodied holding up these signs. Boy, I did let them have it. I explained. The other thing that we try, when you talk about the progressives, changing the wordsmithing, they're good at that, too, and changing history.
Oh, aren't they, though?
Well, this is why we have what we have today with these bureaucratic Lilliputians like the EPA, and they have bastardized that Commerce Clause, because when they read the words that Congress shall make commerce regular, they don't remember what the 1700s was about.
And or what the word meant
about
then.
Yes, because when you got up
regulate
in the morning, if you were regular, you were free-flowing, and that was a good thing for that day. That's what they were talking about.
And that's what to regulate
meant. Oh, and I posted that one, too.
18th century English. Yeah, to make
and
regular.
And that it should be unobstructed. You know, to make it easier.
They have transformed it by calling every nitpicking rule and roadblock a regulation. So if we're going to regulate, that means we have to make regulations, right?
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean,
I can't take it anymore.
word weasels, my dear, word weasels. Yeah, and yeah, weasels at least have useful fur. And these people have useful nothing.
Yeah, the problem is
we can't even skin them and make a coat.
I listen to the talking heads and the bubble heads and the bobbleheads, you know, and everything mm-hmm. from Fox to, you know, a little bit more truth comes out of the Blaze. I do like to watch Glenn. I mean, I'm not 100% on him on everything, and nobody will ever be with – we get that. But the mainstream media, I'm telling you, if Hollywood and the government and mm-hmm. the mainstream media hasn't successfully dumbed down the children, our current school system will surely succeed at that because they're on the road to it, and that's why people are fighting. I think it's November 7th or one of those days. I'm going up with a hopefully carpool up to Seal Beach, California. We're going to have a session on stopping Common Core, and I'm not sure exactly what the venue is, but I'd love to take part in that. So,
And then I can report back to you guys. Good. I'll be waiting. So, I'll be waiting to hear about it. I have just, you know, there's not a lot that little old lady I can do to alter the world. My function, I guess, my purpose is to alter whatever little piece of it I happen to be touching at any given time, which is why I continue to do what I do. And I do have an advantage that a lot of younger people don't, Linda, in that I have seen students come back to me 30 years later and tell me that something that I said or taught them meant something to them, and it helped them build a better life. So I know I have positive mm-hmm. proof that I do touch people's lives. And there's I mentioned once on this show, the little doodad objet de virtu that my Asperger's kid gave me that was a little plaque mirrored bottom with a little sign that says, to teach is to touch a life forever. And it touched me very much because he understood. He mm-hmm. understood what I tried to give him. And I know that that's a fact. Everybody, I've said it so often, darling, we are all teachers, every single one of us. We teach by example as well as by precept. Mm-hmm. And we were taught, you and I, growing up, to look to our elders as our role models. We weren't taught to look to movie stars as role models. Or major league athletes in any role model capacity other than, I'd love to hit a ball like Babe Ruth. You know, it wasn't, I want to be Babe Ruth. I mean, he was a womanizer and everything else. Our role models were supposed to be, and we were taught that they were, our parents, our grandparents, our aunts, our uncles, mm-hmm. our teachers, our ministers, our civic leaders, not politicians, civic leaders.
Firefighters, nurses, doctors.
Giants of history like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, or the knights who forced King John to sign the Magna Carta, rapacious, bloodthirsty demons that they were. They created something that gave the idea, brand new to that world, that people had the right to freedom and to not be have their lives mean nothing except playthings for a monarch's will. And that is one of the founding documents that led to what we enjoy now. And when we don't teach our kids this, when they don't see that long lineage that they are heir to, they will have no understanding that their actions matter.
Right, because also, what rights do you possess if you don't even know you have them or what they are?
Exactly.
Are you
going to notice? How are you going to notice when you no longer have them if you can't even define what they are?
Oh, my gosh.
And progressives are very, very good at the slow erosion.
the slow pot and the frog and the boil. Well, they're going to notice they're going to notice when the petrodollar goes away and the FEMA camps are filled. They'll notice then. Stupid.
Oh, yes. When the co-authored by Glenn Beck book Agenda 21 becomes reality.
Oh,
that's a doggone
good dystopian
book. It really is. Yes. But it's not at all far-fetched in the sense that, yes, it could happen. We don't like to believe or contemplate a world in which it could, but it could happen. Because when you look at the size of this nation, its physical, geographical size, and its size in population, and the incredible number of people who were stupid enough to reelect the current president.
I know.
It ought to scare the living daylights out of many, many people.
Out of us.
Voter fraud notwithstanding. There were enough of them that the voter fraud didn't have to be obvious, like, you know, shoot anybody if they even said the word Republican.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
It was, there were still enough fools out there who believe in the golden promise of hope and change. Hope for what and change for what? They don't bother to ask.
No.
They don't
just
ask
like they
what we're
ask.
Changing to.
Guess
well, what
who else ran on that platform?
Mm-hmm.
Who else ran on that platform? Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yes. Of course.
Back in the day.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
He was an Alinsky disciple, too.
Oh,
and
lovely.
It really gets me. All these idiot kids running around with Che Guevara on their T-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
Filthy, murdering, torturing.
Especially the black kids. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
I've seen that here.
Oh, yeah.
Hated
Che Guevara.
Yeah.
Oh, he did. He wanted Hitler's ovens for anybody who was darker than coffee color. With you know, if you weren't latte, you were there for the ovens.
He was bloodthirsty. Yeah, he was disgusting.
He was.
That guy, he was like Genghis Khan, just sick.
Freedom fighter, my left buttock. No, I don't think so. But it's the old story over and over and over again, and I've said it before, and I'll keep repeating. I have deja vu all over again and feeling like I'm sitting in 1934 Berlin right now.
I know.
I
agree with you.
Watching
it's
all
sad.
Of the empty promises and all of the, we're going to make life perfectly safe and perfectly comfortable and everybody's going to be equal and have equal stuff at everybody's house. Oh, my God. If I could choke that one, I would. Because
yes, me too.
I despise vultures, and that's what he is.
Well, yeah. Oh, sure. And the other thing is, you know, this is why you do what you do and what I do what I do, because if I'm not keeping abreast of what these guys on the other side are doing and planning behind the scenes, this is why I get on that Internet. I read everything I can get my hands on. I also read the books, my fabulous books with real pages and ink on them and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know what the creeps are trying to do, like the EPA. I've just seen the one with the trying to take over the whole country, taking private property rights away. I have read the page and a half on James Madison's view of private property. I do all of these things so that I can try to put a stop to it by explaining to others, if you go down this path, you are
this
going
is what's
to regret
going to
it.
Happen.
Huge. This is what's going to happen to you. And
exactly.
And it's difficult. It's not because I'm an oracle. You know that. I'm not professing to be God. I don't want to be a progressive and climb the ladder to Tower of Babel to try
divinity.
To be on the throne.
I know.
Right.
You don't want to
fill
out an application for the job anymore than I do.
No. So I'm not one of those, you know, philosopher kings at all. And I loathe them, and I can pick them out for you as well as you could do the same. I just need to do these things, and I'm not trying to be a know-it-all. I'm not a know-it-all. I can connect the dots, and I'm like, this is terrifying, people. You have to, if you don't even go back into history long enough to understand who else was talking about hope and change, and I'm sure Castro wasn't the only one. I'll bet Hitler and the rest of them did the same thing.
Of course they did.
Yeah, sure, because they were playing on their fears. I mean,
people,
you know, that's a human trait.
People don't want to believe that bad stuff can happen to them. Even when it does, Linda, they don't want to believe it. And hope is an extraordinarily needful concept, because if you don't have it, you usually kill yourself. Because the reason for doing that is that tomorrow is never going to be any better and is going to definitely be worse than today. So it's a powerful word. But unfortunately...
Sure.
Because we don't educate our children to understand that words mean things, they think in slogans, and they're prey to following people who speak in slogans, who do not give facts. Yeah, who do not want them to think. They want, as the left has always understood, if you get people to stop thinking and start reacting emotionally, they belong to you.
Well, they want clone drones. I mean,
they want people who feel their way through life. And I don't mean touch.
Yeah,
I mean
they do. Yeah.
Emote.
Yeah.
And no, they don't.
Right.
They're very practical. They don't feel anything. They are quite practical and quite clever and quite bright. And they understand that the vast majority of people will be happier with something that makes them feel good than they will with something they'd have to work to achieve and get that
exactly.
good feeling by their own effort. We all, mammals like to get high is the basic understanding. And they do. All mammals. That's
sure.
why elephants eat the spoiled fruit. Why cows eat marijuana, loco weed. We like that feeling. We would love to experience euphoria much more often. And we can convince ourselves that we're going to get it if someone who is charismatic enough uses all the right buzzwords to convince us to start not using our brain and looking for that euphoric feeling. Football game. That's what cheerleaders are for. That's why they're there. And people will follow the band and the cheerleaders and the rah-rah and the look how wonderful we are. We're going to have all this good stuff. And they like that. They want that feeling. They don't want to look at their life and think, well, gee, I've got to work my butt off to try to get this money so I can maybe put a new room on my house because we're expecting our fourth kid. They don't want to think about the work that's involved because unlike many of our ancestors who really believed that work was one's path to salvation, we're telling our children that work is a dirty four-letter word and nobody should have to do it.
The other thing that we have lost sight of, and we must say every day, the mantra of the founders, that the path to liberty is ever vigilance. I mean, just constant.
Yes.
Otherwise, you'll lose it. And I'm seeing
and
that now.
And you'll fall into that emotional trap and become a member of the collective mob. And the mob is easier to steer. It's easier to steer than a thinking individual. Well, we've only got a few minutes left.
I know you're,
right?
You got, okay, love. Talk to you later. I'll be in the chat
room. Thanks for calling, sweetie. It's always a pleasure to hear you. And I want to say thank you to everybody who's joined us this evening. I'm hoping that you'll come back again for Patriot Education next Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And it's still going to be daylight time next week. We don't switch over to standard until the weekend of November 1st. So I'll be here at 6 p.m. EDT for an hour and a half talking about our public education, the history of our nation, and what education has to do with anything. And yes, I may offend somebody, and I'm sorry for you if you feel that way. I'm not intending to, merely giving you my admittedly potentially incorrect opinion, but bless it, it's mine own. And I thank the folks at Patriot Families who support this nation and who are supporting all of our radio shows so that all of you out there listening and my friends in the chat room get a look at the world from the conservative libertarian side at least once or twice a week if you really want it. And I hope that you'll be here for every one of our shows. And I thank you again for your kindly ear. As always, my greatest love to my greatest fan. Good night, folks, and God bless.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education, and on Friday at 7 p.m. you can listen to Exposed But Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.